Okay, so last week we looked at the background, the historical background to the Book of Esther, and hope you found that interesting. You may not agree with it, but at least I presented some points favouring Darius Hystaspes. Tonight we want to get into the name of God in the Book of Esther, the parable of the kingdom, and how Esther chapter 1 is a parable of the kingdom, and focus on the character studies of Ahasuerus and Vashti. And then next week, our final class, this time, we'll continue the theme of the parable of the kingdom, focusing on Esther and Mordecai, and then look at the complete contrast of Haman with the big lesson when we study Haman's character, is that the flesh, which is in all of us, the diabolos in us all, must be put to death. Just to quickly recap what we learnt last week, we were looking basically at whether the Esther belongs to Darius. Okay, Esther was taken to the King Ahasuerus in his royal house in the seventh year of his reign. So, of course, the question is, the seventh year of who? Okay, was it Darius Hystaspes or was it Xerxes? So that was the question. But in summary, what we saw is, due to the cumulative evidence of the Bible's own statements and chronologies, we looked into the ages of Mordecai and Ezra, and the terms Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes being titles, not names, just like we would call a king or Caesar or Pharaoh. Historical artifacts, including the Behistun inscription of Darius the Great, that's consistent with what we read in the Bible, and additional confirmation from the historical apocryphal writings regarding the story of Esther. So we saw that all of that is sufficient to establish that Esther was married to Darius Hystaspes. Darius Hystaspes of Ezra chapter 6, verse 14 to 15, is the same king as Artaxerxes, the king, the great king of seven chapter one, you know, and Ezra basically is in the sixth year, you know, when was there, and in the seventh year, Ezra then went to Jerusalem under the decree, under the grant of Artaxerxes. And also Darius Hystaspes is the same king as the Artaxerxes of Nehemiah. So when Nehemiah made that request, it was indeed, in my view, Esther was sitting on the throne next to Artaxerxes. So it all comes together. So like this. So the first year, okay, of Darius Hystaspes, Daniel was given the 70-week prophecy. In the second year, Haggai and Zechariah commenced their prophecy. The temple work was recommenced and finished, rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem over the seventh to the sixth year. Then in the seventh year of Artaxerxes, or Darius, Esther becomes queen. Ezra returns to Israel with the second group. And then in the 20th year, there's a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, and Nehemiah leaves to go back. So there was just one problem with all this, is that the 490-year prophecy didn't quite fit. We can work, that's a timestamp, because we worked that out based on the date of Christ. Going back, we should come back actually into this area, not to Xerxes, but even after, to Artaxerxes number 1, 465 to 424 BC. But the problem with that, we think, can be resolved simply by considering that there's a lot of uncertainty in those years and the dating of the 10 Persian kings. Okay, so as one expert on the chronology of the Old Testament said, despite the fact that Ptolemy is a mere late second century compiler writing nearly 100 years after Christ, so our whole basis for the 10 kings of the Persian Empire and how long they each reigned was written by someone who wrote 100 years after Christ, well after the event. It's just what everyone, he's our only authority, for no other system bridges that gulf. So everyone just still relies on him, regardless of the fact that he was far removed, okay, from the time periods he said were the case. The Bible itself, the point is, the Bible itself is the most reliable reference point to date history. And so it's easy to understand that this period could have been overstated by approximately 50 years. And so if we if we do that, then everything will fit. Okay, we move them forward in time, forward 50 years, and then the 70-week prophecy occurs, okay, in line with what the Bible says on the decree to go forth and to build the walls, okay, of Jerusalem when Darius gave that to Nehemiah. Okay, so on to tonight's class. The Book of Esther, it's a drama of good versus evil. It reminds us that God is in control. He's the main character. Even though he's not directly mentioned, we see a lot of providence, a lot of events that are orchestrated by God behind the scenes. Now, Israel's disobedience resulted in God allowing the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and take the Jews into captivity. They were there for 70 years. But 70 years later, Cyrus the Great invaded Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire commenced, and the Jews were allowed to return home to Jerusalem. However, the problem was most refused. Most stayed there. Okay, in comparison to the Jews that came back to do the work of rebuilding the temple, most stayed there. They'd become Persianized. They were fully entrenched in the culture of the kingdom around them. And so the Jews of Esther's day were the grandchildren of those who were exiled. Why return to a broken city with nothing when we have everything here? You know, we can imagine the kids saying to their father and grandfathers, oh, look, stop talking about how things were in your day. You know, in my day, you know how kids knock us for saying that sort of thing. When I was young, I didn't do that. Well, kids don't like us saying that, do they? But anyway, I'm just making the point that you get a couple of generations go by and the young people growing up in that environment were very comfortable. Why go back, okay, to a city with nothing when they had everything there? So this partially explains why the Book of Esther never mentions Jerusalem, the temple, the Abrahamic covenant, the Passover or Yahweh, because God had to work on another angle, okay, to convince them of the truth and to remind them of who they were, that they were God's people. So appearances can be deceiving. When we read tonight in Esther chapter 1, it looks like Ahasuerus is there in control of the greatest kingdom on earth, seated on his throne in Susa. However, the shadow of providence is hovering just above his throne. God is the king. He's behind the scene. And so we know these words well from Daniel chapter 4. The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. This was true in Esther's day. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. He does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? Darius Hystaspes was a no one. He was the son of a general, but he rose to be the greatest and most important person in the Middle East, in the then known world, the king of Persia. So truly God set us up over the kingdoms of men, whom he will, including the lowliest men. So whatever the Lord does, he pleases, in heaven and earth, in the seas and in all deep places. God is in control, and that's the lesson for us today too. Despite all the confusion, despite all the complexity in world events and what's going on, all the fear that the nations have, God is in control. Everything's working out according to his plan. And so the Book of Esther, when we read it, it doesn't so much impress us about Esther. When we take a step back and think about it, it really impresses us about God. All right, now the name of Yahweh in the Book of Esther, the king's name is 190 times there, but why isn't God's name there? And it's the only book of the Bible in which the name of God appears to be missing. We've seen many people say, oh, it's questionable, that book, you know, whether it really should be part of the canon of Scripture. So why isn't God's name explicitly mentioned? Well, I think there may be, first of all, a reason why it's not there. And that's the scriptural reason that we read in Deuteronomy 31. So, Michael, could you read this for us, please? Deuteronomy 31, verse 16 to 18.
This people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And for all that I will surely hide my face in that day, evils which they have wrought, in that they are turned unto other gods.
Thanks, Michael. So you see, God declared that if his people forsook him, then he would hide his face from them. And so that's what happened. That when the Jews were there, second, third generation, exiled in Babylon and Persia, they forsake God, okay? They broke the covenant, okay? And many of them, as I said, didn't bother returning. They're so entrenched in that country that they were there. And so there's a principle that then God will hide his face in that day, okay, when they turn to other gods. Now, it's interesting that the word I will surely hide here in the Hebrew is satam safar. Hiding, I will hide, is how it literally reads. Now, Esther, the name of Esther, the root Hebrew word is safar, and that means hidden or secret. So Esther, the name of Esther means something hidden. Okay, so the book of Esther is a clear example of God fulfilling his word. God was hiding his face from his people on account of their sins. They had deliberately chosen to continue in the land of their captivity among the heathen instead of them availing themselves of the opportunity to return to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel. However, though he was hidden from them, he was actually still working for them and going to teach them an important lesson. Now, keeping that in mind, it's interesting that to the Jews, the book of Esther is known as Megillat Esther. Okay? That is the scroll of Esther. So Megillah is something that is revealed as when a scroll is unrolled. And Esther, as we've seen, means hidden or secret. So putting it together, Megillat Esther means a revealing of that which is hidden. And so likewise, the name of God is hidden in the book of Esther. And we're going to look at three examples of that.
And Matt, just before you go on, so yeah. When you say the name of Yahweh is not in any other book of the Bible, you meant the Old Testament?
Yeah, the Old Testament.
Yeah. Obviously. So there's no mention of God, is there at all, is there? Like the word God?
No, not even the word God is not there.
The yeah, yeah.
So Yahweh or Elohim,
yeah.
No, it's not there. Ael. In the book of Esther. So let's look at, but I've got something to show you. So let's look at three examples. So it's hidden via an acrostic form. Okay. So an acrostic is when the initial letter of each line or of each word in the Hebrew spells out a word. So Yahweh occurs four times in the form of an acrostic. Of four consecutive words in the Hebrew text. Okay, so in one chapter 1, verse 20, it occurs as a backward acrostic, so H-W-H-Y, spoken by Memucan, a Gentile. Then in 5, verse 4, a forward acrostic, spoken when Esther speaks, and she's a Jew. Then in chapter 5, verse 13, it's a backward acrostic, spoken by Haman, a Gentile. And in chapter 7, when it's a forward acrostic spoken by the author, likely Mordecai, who's a Jew. And so there's synergy in this and there's consistency in what they're talking about. So it's interesting to note. And so when it's spoken by a Gentile, the Yahweh is there backwards. When it's spoken by a Jew, Yahweh is there forward. And even the name Aya, he who will be, also appears in the acrostic in 7 verse 5. Okay, so that's one reason. That's one example. Secondly, it's hidden via an attachment to the word Jews. in the book. Now, the word Yehudim, the Jews, right, is misspelt with a double yod 6 times in the book of Esther in those locations. 4 verse 7, 8 verse 1, 8 verse 7, verse 13, 9 verse 15 and 18. So Yehudim, plural, or Yehudi, singular. So this is deliberate. No other word is misspelt. It's like putting a double Y, as I've done. They put a double Y or a double yod in front of it. No other word is misspelt in the book. And so the extra Y is an abbreviation of Yahweh, and it's attached to the word Jews. And so the point is, Yahweh is actually still among his chosen people, the Jews. And that's actually connected to the next point. It's hidden via the Hebrew Aleph Tav. Does anyone know what they are? The Hebrew letters Aleph and Tav?
A is the first letter of their alphabet.
Yes, Aleph is the first and Tav is the?
Last.
The last. Yeah, that's right. It's the first and the last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And it occurs more than 74 times in the book of Esther. Okay. But overall, this is not unusual. It's 7,000 times this occurs in the Old Testament. However, it's not translated. We don't read it. The Hebrews read it. Okay. Ayas is how they pronounce it. But it's not translated. So here's enhanced Strong's lexicon on the word, Hebrew 853. Untranslated particle, but apparently contracted from Hebrew 226 in the demonstrative sense of entity. It's a sign of the definite direct object. Not translated in English, but generally preceding and indicating the accusative or the object in the sentence. So, however, there's many more objects in the Hebrew text do not have this marker. Okay, so only some have them. It's not consistent. Now, I know when I learn other languages, particularly Korean, you have a subject marker and you'll have an object marker, and it's there every single occasion. As a rule of grammar, it's there. But in Hebrew, it's not. It's only there in certain circumstances. So this is interesting. Now, it's from the word, contracted from the word 226. So we look into that. It's just what the Strong's Concordance says again, uth. Okay, so they say probably from 225 in the sense of appearing. It's translated here as signs, ensigns, miracles, a mark, a signal, a distinguishing mark. Okay, so it comes from a word that means a sign, a mark, something that is distinguishing. And this word itself, the root comes from a word that means to consent or to agree. So it's a mark of consentment. It's a mark of signaling something important. You can get the sense. Okay, so that's the meaning of this word that's not translated in English, but is there all throughout the Old Testament, including 74 times in the book of Esther. Now, here's the thing, and here's why this is important. I just think it's impossible to dismiss this as just, well, something in the grammar that doesn't really mean much to us today. This is equivalent to Alpha and Omega in the Greek. The beginning and the end, the first and the last. Now, what does the New Testament tell us about the Greek letters, the Alpha and the Omega? Who does that represent?
God.
It does, doesn't it? Revelation, chapter 1, verse 8. It's really broader than God. I am Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the ending, saith the Lord, which is and was and which is to come, the Almighty. So it's the name of God, right? It's the name of the Father who will be manifested in a multitude of mighty ones. Here, Jesus Christ is actually speaking. He has the name of God and can say that. I am the Alpha and the Omega. It's the divine family name. It's the Alpha and the Omega. It incorporates all the saints from the beginning to the end, all together as a unified, you know, manifesting God. So this is the name of the Father. So I really think this is important. Now, if you were in the New Testament and you saw this, I am the Alpha and the Omega, this isn't foreign to you. You know, when you're reading this in Greek, in the first century, because you know in the Hebrew Old Scriptures, this was a hallmark of the Old Testament. The Aleph and the Tav was all throughout it. So it didn't have its basis just made up in the New Testament. It's drawing, I think, from the Old Testament use of this very important object, which I think is placed there to illustrate that God is working in certain situations. Now, let's have an example. Before we get to Esther, we'll have a look at a couple of examples in Esther. Just have a look in the book of Ruth. Now, before, this is a reverse interlinear, okay? Taking the screenshot from a reverse interlinear here. And so you can see the English and then the Hebrew name for Ruth and then the Hebrew word here for the Strong's code 7327. So this is where Ruth occurs in chapter 1. And why did I put this up? I just put this up to show that you haven't got Aleph Tov, okay, before Ruth in chapter 1. When she's a Moabite, it doesn't come before Ruth. And it's interesting that the first occurrence of Aleph Tov in the book of Ruth is in verse 6, okay, when it speaks about then Naomi arose with a daughter-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she heard in the fields of Moab that Yahweh had visited his people and given them his food. So before Yahweh's people, the Jews, we have this Aleph Tov there, okay, the name of God, the Alpha and the Omega. Okay, so that's interesting. Now, in chapter 1, as a Moabite, before her name, Aleph Tov is not there. But when we get to the final chapter, when she's married now to Boaz and incorporated into the hope of Israel, we have Aleph Tov before her name. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. This is Boaz speaking. And then all the people who were set at the gate, and the elders said, we are witnesses. May Yahweh make the woman before, in other words, Ruth. May Yahweh make this woman. And there you have the Ayah, the Aleph Tov, who was coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel, Aleph Tov, before that. And then so again in verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife, Aleph Tov, before that. So it's deliberate, okay? It's not random, I think. The placing of this Aleph Tov, which we know from the New Testament is the Alpha and the Omega, the name of God, is deliberate and indicates it. So I think we miss this in English, but it's there in the Hebrew. Now, the first occurrence of Aleph Tov in the book of Esther is in chapter 1, verse 4, where it speaks about Ahasuerus showing the riches of his royal glory and the splendor, okay, of his pomp and greatness for many days, for 180 days. So the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his pomp and greatness, we have the mark of God before that. So what's it telling us? It came from God, okay? He set him up, okay? He would be nothing without God's hand in the matter. Then let's have a look at a few examples in Esther chapter 2. So in verse 1, we read, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti. So before Vashti, we have the Aleph Tov. And what she'd done, Aleph Tov before that, and what had been decreed against her, the Aleph Tov before that. So you see, everything to do with Vashti, what had happened, and the decree that was made, that was all divine providence. That was all God's working. That's what we're being told. Then we move down to Esther chapter 2, verse 7. Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah. That is Esther. So before her, we have Aleph Tov, the mark of God. Verse 10, Esther had not made known her people, the Jews. Okay, before that, before the Jews, we have the Aleph Tov, or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded not to make it known. And so in verse 11, and every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So again, before Esther, we have the Aleph Tov. Okay, so I think this is interesting. It's very interesting. In chapter 2, it goes on. In verse 17, the king loved Esther, Aleph Tov there, before Esther. In verse 18, the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast, the name of God, before that. And Esther 2, verse 20, Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, again, the Jews. Before that, the name of God. But Esther obeyed Mordecai, before Mordecai, we have Aleph Tov. So I think it's more than just an object marker. It's telling something important, that God is the orchestrator of events behind the scenes. And I think the fact that in the New Testament, we're directly told the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last in the Greek, is to do with the name of God. I think we can be confident that it's the same in the Old Testament as well. Okay, so there's three reasons why I think the name of God is hidden, okay, but it's there in the book of Esther. And I hope you found that interesting, as I have found that very interesting as well. The key question for the Jews in Persia, it's not whether God will prove sovereign over his people in Jerusalem. Remember, they've all, because they stayed behind, right? They didn't go with Zerubbabel. It's whether he will prove sovereign over his people that remained in Persia. And it's not whether he will lead and direct those who chose to return home. No, it's whether God will lead and direct those who stayed in Persia. And so God didn't abandon those Jews who did not return to Jerusalem. He was still with them. Okay, but nevertheless, he still required them to worship in him in spirit and in truth. And he orchestrated adverse circumstances and trials to test them. So the point is that the book of Esther reminds us that even when God's people forget him, he doesn't forget them. Now, of course, we're generalizing about all of the Jews who remained behind. Obviously, there were still some very faithful Jews. Mordecai himself, contemporary with Ezra, who did return, okay, but was called back to Persia because of the circumstances concerning Esther. And we know later that Esther requested prayer and fasting to be made for her for 3 days, and all of the Jews did this. So when we come into the story of Esther chapter 1 and 2, the rejection of Vashti and the selection of Esther, this is a parable of the kingdom. Okay, so just the parable of the future kingdom. When Jesus Christ returns, okay, and he's the king, and how he's going to interact with the whole world. So just keep that in mind, and we'll summarize that at the end. Now, we want to move on to the character of Ahasuerus. And the common view of Ahasuerus is he's an absolute dirty, rotten scoundrel. Okay, he's a tyrant. And most commentaries will say this, he was a typical tyrant, self-centered, considering himself above the law, exercising power in a harsh and cruel manner. And he was bad-tempered and frequently drunk. And he wanted to parade Vashti as one of his possessions before his guests. And many commentators suggest that probably he demanded that Vashti appear partially unclothed before everyone, or that she should dance, okay, like the case of John the Baptist, before everyone. And that Vashti had simply reached the limit of her ability to put up with Ahasuerus' bad behavior. And so on this occasion, she took a heroic stand and refused the king's command. And then after divorcing Vashti, Ahasuerus' tyrannical ways were tamed, or maybe somewhat tamed, by a Hebrew slave girl who became the new queen. So that's the typical view. And as we've said, as was mentioned last week, often, you know, people believe that Xerxes, okay, was the queen in Esther's day. Xerxes. And if that was the case, I would agree. But because we think that Darius was the king, personally, I don't agree with that. There's no doubt that Xerxes was a terrible king. Okay, Herodotus records to us about Xerxes a couple of famous infamous incidents that really tell us about what character of person he was. So just reading this, a man named Pythias offered Ahasuerus. Now remember, Ahasuerus is a title. It's not it could apply to any king of Persia. A man named Pythias offered Ahasuerus an enormous amount of money in support of his military expedition against Greece. So Ahasuerus, moved by this man's loyalty, returned the gift and sent the present back to Pythias. Now, what did he do next? When Pythias asked Ahasuerus to allow his oldest son to remain home from the war, the king, enraged by the request, ordered the son to be cut in two pieces and had the whole army march between them on their way to the battle. So Ahasuerus accepted all this money from this wealthy man to help finance his expedition and then killed his son, you know, off a small request. So this is terrible, isn't it? What kind of man is this that just impulsively acts like this, okay? Just entirely on his own whim and entirely based on his own rage. On another occasion, Xerxes traveled back to Susa and wintered in the city of Sardis, where he tried to seduce his sister-in-law. And she then refused his advances. He tried to seduce his own sister-in-law. And when she refused, later he had her and her husband, his own brother, tortured to death. Not a very nice man at all. And then you may have heard of this incident. This incident's quite famous. During his expedition against Greece, the same where he and more than 100,000 soldiers were held off for 7 days by Leonidas and the 300 brave Spartans. I think they've made a movie out of this, 300 or something. The 300 brave Spartans at the Battle of Thermopylae, I can't say that correctly, Ahasuerus attempted to build two bridges across the river to accommodate his huge army. Now, although they were successfully built, a storm rose up and destroyed the bridges overnight. So what did he do? Furious and delusional, the king had the soldiers beat the river with the whip 300 times. Okay, one for each of those 300 Spartans, while the other soldiers all shouted and cursed at the water. And then he ordered that a pair of shackles be thrown into the river to symbolize his sovereignty over the waters, even though he'd failed. And as final proof, then what he did do, he had the bridge engineers all beheaded. Okay, so what a terrible guy. Now, I believe this is completely at odds with the Ahasuerus that we read in Esther. So let's go through a few points. He's generous. He holds two feasts, 180 days for all his princes and servants, and 7 days for all people in Shushan. He shows no partiality. Everyone's invited, both great and small. So that would have cost him a lot of money to put on that feast. Everyone was invited. And he treats everyone like royalty. Wine flows in abundance for everyone. And drinking was according to the law. The king did not compel people to drink. And he did not allow mixed feasting or dancing. Right? Vashti feasted with the women separately, not openly in the court of the garden, but in the royal house. And we can contrast that with the feast of Belshazzar, okay, when his wives and his concubines drank with him, or that of Herod, okay, whose daughter danced before, the daughter of Herodias danced before him. Completely different. Ahasuerus showed the honor of his majesty, and Vashti and her ladies were required to show the honor of their modesty. He was law-abiding. He respected the Persian law, even when publicly shamed and personally challenged by Vashti. He didn't react impulsively. He didn't take matters into his own hand. Okay, he consulted with others about what should be done and what the law said should be done. Although merry with wine, he's not drunk. And although his anger burned in him, he's not reckless and out of control. And so if he's a typical tyrant, like Belshazzar, then his attraction to Esther and his selection of Mordecai actually reflect poorly on him. So again, although he's publicly shamed by his wife and he's filled with anger, he didn't take matters into his own hand. He surrounded himself with counselors who were well-versed in the law. He didn't use his own power to seek revenge against Vashti, but submitted to the Persian law. And, you know, he's not reckless. He has the type of character that Vashti thought she could rebel against and succeed. Vashti knew that her husband had a soft and kind character, that he loved her, and by himself, he would never do anything drastic like divorcing her or killing her. Okay, later in chapter 2, we read that he remembered it and, you know, what had happened to her. And the record is even almost like he wanted to bring her back somehow. And so perhaps if it was Ahasuerus' decision alone, he would have forgiven her. But he submitted to the law of the Persians. And so to help him forget Vashti, his servants arranged a grand procedure lasting 12 months for the king to select a new queen. And so he's a benevolent ruler throughout the whole book of Esther. He loves Esther for her character, not her outward beauty. He shows grace and favor to her three times. Three times Esther risked her life. Three times he shows grace and favor to her. Haman knows he must deceive the king about the Jews, or the king would never agree to the proposed decree just to get money. Haman offered a lot of wealth. Okay, I think Xerxes just would have accepted regardless. Haman could have just told him who it was and here's all the money. And Xerxes, the type of character he was, he would have accepted it. And later we read that he seeks to redress the wrong that was done in failing to reward the man whose loyal service saved his life. And so he has hard, and that was of course Mordecai, he has high regard for Persian law. He knows he can't overturn a decree, even though he may not support it. So his judgment is consistently based on what is lawful and just for the empire, not what's best for him. He's not necessarily a God-fearing man, but his character was no accident. God raised him up for a very special purpose, much the same way as several other Gentile kings who were sympathetic to the Jews were raised up by God during their period of captivity. So he values Mordecai for his character and judgment and elevates him to be prime minister. So I don't think it's Xerxes. I think it's more likely an entirely different character, more likely Darius. Now, let's talk about Vashti's rebellion. In summary, she rejected her need to honour her husband. The purpose of the king's feast was to publicly display the honour, the majesty, the glory and the beauty of the empire, which we saw before, all came from God. Okay? The Aleph Tov is all in that phrase. And the feasts were also designed to promote goodwill, right living, loyal service to the empire. And, of course, the queen plays a vital role in promoting that, just like the queen does today. Okay, and the princesses who the royal family are married to, they are public figures with an important role to play to the world. Now, the king was not out to demean Vashti, but rather to present her as part of the majesty of the kingdom. Now, though it was common in Persian culture for dancers to entertain the king's guests, the view that the king would have asked Vashti to dance partially naked is inconsistent with Persian customs, that the queen, and this is according to the JFB commentary, the queen, even more than the wives of other men, was secluded from public gaze. That was the culture. So the king then made her the centerpiece. He brought her out from being secluded from public gaze, which was the normal thing. And remember, he'd invited everyone, low, all the citizens, low and high, to be there. Normally, they wouldn't have the honor of seeing the beauty of the queen. But the king made her the centerpiece of the final, this final grand day. And he pays her the highest tribute with full dignity and honor. And so it's much, much like what we see in the royal weddings today. The focus of these marriages is on the woman. Even though the person who has all the power is the king or the prince or the king-to-be, the whole world is focused at that point on the beauty and the woman. Now, what about Vashti? Well, remember from last class, okay, we mentioned that during the first year of his reign, Darius married Atossa, okay, according to the historians, and she was the previously twice married daughter of Cyrus. Okay, so Cyrus's daughter was Atossa. Cyrus's son, Cambyses, who reigned for a short period, married his own sister, okay, Atossa. And then when he died and there was a usurper before Darius came along, she was married to this other man as well, briefly. So two times she was already married, and then finally she was married to Darius. So this is how the, if you like, the Persian Empire came about, because it's the Medo-Persians. The Medes came from Cyrus and Vashti, Atossa, okay? They married into, okay, the Persian line through Darius. So they, through marriage, they came together. And that's what Darius had done in marrying Atossa. Nevertheless, his character was he just didn't do it for political reasons, okay? He did it because he genuinely loved her and he genuinely wanted to be her husband. So, as we said last week, Bishop James Usher, in his Annals of the World, equates Atossa with Vashti. And according to Herodotus, Atossa was not his most favoured wife, okay? Rather, it was another young virgin who we believe was likely to be Esther. They've just got different names and they're concealed by the Persian chroniclers. But anyway, the important thing is to remember who Vashti was, okay? She would think she's got royal blood in her. She's the daughter of Cyrus, okay? The real king of the, you know, of the Medes. Okay, who is Darius? He was just this general in the army who's risen to be king. So when they come together, what does she think? Well, I think, you know, as the daughter of Cyrus, she may have considered herself more important than her husband. And so the source of Vashti's rebellion is a desire to be equal, if not thinking herself better than her husband, rather than subject to him. According to Josephus, Ahasuerus sent his seven honourable messengers again and again to Vashti, pleading to come out. So in chapter 1, in verse 10, when we read that on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehaman, Bithsa, Habona, Bigtha, and Abakatha, Zetha, and Carcass, the seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus, to bring Vashti the queen before the king. So he just didn't send seven altogether. Okay, there'd be no need to send seven altogether, right? He did them one by one. Okay, so the first one went. So Mehaman went. He was unsuccessful. Comes back. Then Ahasuerus sends Bithsa. He didn't work. So then next, and it goes forward all the way through those seven princes who are around him. That he continually tried and tried, made seven attempts, separate attempts, pleading with Vashti to come. But she aimed to publicly humiliate her husband, to dishonor him in his own household. And rather than seeking to privately discuss the cause of her unhappiness with her husband, she picked an opportune time. Okay, a critical moment when everyone was there, everyone important, all were there, low and high, to publicly rebel before everyone. And her rebellion would reverberate throughout the whole empire. So, you know, this obviously there's maybe other reasons why she was upset as well. You know, the feast for the women was confined inside the royal house, whereas the feast for the men was outside in the palace gardens. Okay, the king had waited until the last day of the feast to call her, rather than calling her to be with him for the first day. But nevertheless, Ahasuerus was keeping abiding by Persian culture and custom, and his motive was not to demote or to demean her, certainly not to ask her to come and dance half naked before everyone. He was aiming to present her as the jewel, as the crown of the empire at the finale of the feast. So Memucan recognized that what had happened in the palace would impact every Persian household. It wasn't the king's ego that was threatened, but rather the domestic stability of the empire. So the wives would generate contempt, disesteeming their husbands, who would respond in wrath. Okay, there would be that conflict in the household, which was predicted actually from Genesis 3 verse 16, between a man and a woman naturally, unguided by spiritual way of life, there's conflict there. And the result would be a torrent of domestic upheaval throughout the whole empire. And so the remedy for Vashti's rebellion is a new law reaffirming the need for wives to honour their husband in verse 20. And this is the divine principle, isn't it, that we learn in the New Testament as well, that wives are to submit to their husbands. Michael, could you read here at the bottom, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22 to 24.
Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the ecclesia, and he is the saviour of the body. Therefore, as the ecclesia is subject unto Christ, so that the wives be to their own husbands in everything.
Thanks. So this principle was established on the sixth day of creation, 1 Timothy 13, verse 2, we know. Adam was first formed, and it's interesting, in 1 Timothy 2, the apostle gives two reasons why the wife should be subject to the husband. The first is Adam was first formed, and that happened before sin. Okay. The second is related to what happened when they sinned. Eve was deceived. But even before that, God's original design from creation, Adam was first formed, is the important number one reason. The husband is the head, and this is applicable to all marriages. Now, when it is obeyed, God is glorified, and the foolishness of Eve is avoided. And there's a natural resentment, isn't it? Any time one person is asked to submit to another, you read the context of Ephesians chapter 5, it's all about everyone being submissive one to another. We all have to submit to one another. But there's a natural resentment any time we're asked to do that. But we've got to humble ourselves and do it. Vashti's contempt for her husband was not unique. And most wives experience this same feeling in their marriage. But God asks a wife to submit to her husband, not because he deserves it necessarily at all, but by faith and out of love. And she's not absolved of this requirement, even if her husband doesn't believe the truth or is spiritually weak, as the Apostle Peter says in chapter 3. You know, any has a husband outside the truth, he may be convinced by the conversation and the behaviour of the wife. And so a wife who explains away her need to submit to her husband rejects the divine command here and follows Vashti thinking. But on the other hand, we also read in Ephesians chapter 5 that husbands are to sanctify and agape love their wives. In other words, do everything they can to help their wives to get into the kingdom, to sacrifice them for them. Michael, can you read this as well? Ephesians 5, verse 25 to 29.
Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the ecclesia and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious ecclesia, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord, the Ecclesia.
Thanks, Michael. So Christ has established the accountability for each husband to do all he can to save his wife, to do all he can. And this is just not making the wife feel comfortable, okay, and making her happy. Agape love really is everything about helping her get into the kingdom, making sure she gets into the kingdom. Remember in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, though I give my body to be burnt, though I give all the money to the poor, I can still not have agape love. So agape love is just not sacrifice for the sake of sacrificing and making someone feel better. It's got an objective in mind. Okay, it's an objective to get each other into the kingdom, to save his wife eternally. And so the husband is to sanctify his wife by first sanctifying himself. That's separating yourself from the world's influence and washing yourself with the word of God. You've got to do that. The husbands have to be doing that first to themselves, and then they can help their wife. He is to wash her in the word, to nourish, to cherish her above all other relationships, to love her as his own body. And likewise, he too is to love her by faith, not because she's earned his love or she deserves his love. Okay? Goes both ways here. But out of obedience to God. And so as a husband's responsibility to love his wife does not hinge upon how good of a wife she is, her character, whether she deserves it, or whether she responds to his love or not. And it doesn't matter about her lack of spirituality or her unfavorable response to his love. He's still got to keep trying, regardless. So there's a balance here in the role of the husband and the role of the wife. The husband's got to do everything he can to help his wife. And the wife has to do everything she can to submit to her husband. So the parable of Esther chapter 1, it's all about the future kingdom. We'll skip over these very quickly because we're out of time. But you can see that the feast was held by the king to show the riches of his glory, kingdom, honor of his majesty. It's clearly what's going to happen when Christ returns and he's the king in Jerusalem. Those invited represent the power, okay, of the kingdom. Those who rule with the king, that's our hope, to rule on the earth with Jesus Christ. It lasts for 7 days. It's held outside in a garden with green vegetable hangings. That's typical of the Feast of the Tabernacles, the feast in the kingdom age. We know that from Zechariah 14. None are compelled to attend or to participate. So with us, to get into the kingdom, to be there, a personal desire, okay, and our effort to be there is necessary. And there's other things here. Drink from golden vessels, the redeemed, their tried faith, come from all walks of life, the royal wine, the wine of the kingdom. Those invited are great and small. And some are rejected, as Vashti was. Those who refuse to honor and obey the king, they are banned forever from his presence. But another group is selected in their place who are better, since they chose to obey the king and willingly reflect his glory. There's multiple references to seven days, seven eunuchs, seven wise men, Esther's maidens in chapter 2, the year she's crowned, the seventh year of Ahasuerus, and all points to the future age. So let's finish now. So tonight we've seen the name of God in the book of Esther. I hope you've got a little bit more confidence that the name of God is actually there, even though it's hidden, like I have. We've looked at the character of Ahasuerus and Vashti, but Ahasuerus wasn't such a bad king after all. He was quite a reasonable man. And that Vashti, as the daughter of Cyrus, it somewhat explains her position of pomp and arrogance towards her husband. Next week, we'll focus on the character of Esther and Mordecai and Haman. So thanks, everyone. We'll leave it there. Thank you.